We've got summer travel on today's program, and fireworks, but also cats and coffee. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 4th of July. Good to have you with us on this Independence Day. It's a day marred by yet another mass shooting in our country. A gunman killed at least six people and injured dozens more at a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois, near Chicago. With that situation still unfolding, we are going to stick to the business and economic news of the day. Starting with travel, nearly 48 million people were expected to travel at least 50 miles this holiday weekend, says AAA. That's about one in seven Americans. And air travel has been getting pretty close to pre-pandemic levels. But the cost of gas and airfares and hotels is way up, too, which may put a dent in what many in the hospitality and leisure industries had hoped would be a summer travel boom. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
American consumers are less worried about getting COVID and more willing to climb onto crowded trains, buses, and airplanes. So they've been returning to travel with a vengeance. Lindsay Roschke tracks consumer behavior at Morning Consult.
People have been calling this revenge travel, right? Get back out there and do things they haven't had the opportunity or they haven't felt comfortable doing.
But she says travel's getting more expensive. So Morning Consult finds consumers are planning to drive less and take fewer trips than last summer.
With all the frustrations with air travel, it's not like gas prices are cheap. So it's kind of hard to trade off and do a road trip instead.
As summer wears on and sticker shock sinks in, travel will wane, says Dana Peterson at the conference board.
Prices for everything are rising. So it's not just gasoline, but also restaurants, hotels, entertainment, like going to your favorite sporting event or going to the movies.
If you are going to travel, be ready for disruptions, says retail analyst Marshall Cohen at the NPD Group. He was recently scheduled to fly from New York to Florida to visit a client.
The flight got canceled. They were saying, well, I guess we'll have to reschedule. I said, oh, no, I'll be there tomorrow. In the car I got, 16 hours later, there I was.
But most people can't shift gears on a dime and drive to their summer vacation if their flight's canceled. So they might just end up with a staycation instead. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
It probably almost goes without saying that this year's July 4th barbecue is also turning out to be more expensive, with inflation chugging along at above 8% by some measures. Prices have also increased for the evening's climax, the fireworks, both the little ones you might set off in your backyard and the big shows that towns and cities put on in the park. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that story.
As you can imagine, for the fireworks industry, this is go time.
There is no 5th of July in our business.
Bill Weimer is vice president at Phantom Fireworks, which has stores in 15 states. He says 90% of his sales happen in the month leading up to today. The rest are mostly during New Year's and Diwali. And this year, the product is more expensive.
We're not unlike most businesses. We've had inflation hit us, so our prices are up 20, 25, 30%.
And that's mostly down to shipping. Most fireworks come from China. Weimer says shipping costs have quadrupled. And that's on top of the premium the industry already pays because its products are explosives. Michael Cardellano at fireworks display company Pyrotechnico says inflation is also affecting local fireworks shows, which cost anywhere from 10 grand to whatever you're willing to spend.
This is a bad phrase, but I'll say the sky's the limit.
He says most towns are trimming costs by shortening shows. A 25-minute display might become 20 minutes. But the increase in prices isn't putting too big of a dent in the industry, says Steve Hauser, president of the National Fireworks Association. Cities that canceled public shows for the past couple of years because of COVID are eager to bring back the tradition. And during that time, consumer fireworks sales got a boost.
A lot of people were like, well, I can't go to the city show, so I'm going to try fireworks in my backyard.
He also thinks with the price of gas, people figure if they're going to stay home today, they may as well go all out. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
The markets were closed for the holiday, but we'll let you know what was going on off Wall Street when we do the numbers. You may have noticed a few more for sale signs in your neighborhood lately. I certainly have. And the numbers back us up. Realtor.com says active real estate listings rose 19% in June from a year ago as more sellers look to cash in on record high home prices and would-be buyers balk at higher mortgage rates. All this suggests what had been a nearly impossible housing market for many first-time buyers may be easing up. For a view from the ground, we called up Amanda Pullman, a broker at Keller Williams Living in the Cleveland, Ohio area, to see how her clients are faring.
Well, if they haven't got exhausted with losing so many homes, there is definitely a reprieve. However, the interest rates are in some cases kind of almost pushing them out of the market. So our first-time home buyers definitely have more of a opportunity to win in multiple offer situations. And that's the good news. But I think, you know, what the feds have done with the rates and slowing down inflation has definitely pushed some people out of being able to afford homes.
And what are you hearing from sellers who may have been hoping to cash out at the top of the market, or at least when prices were very high? Are they starting to lower prices and maybe do a little bit more to try to encourage sales?
Yes, they don't know necessarily that the market, the top of the market, is behind us. You know, what used to be, let's say, 7 days on the market might now be 21 days on the market. But the opportunity with the realtors is to have that conversation with sellers that it could be longer. So sellers are still a little bit kind of pie in the sky with what they think they can get for their homes. And that's going to be a little bit more of a wake-up call for some of them that are priced wrong for this moving and correcting market.
When I called you up the first time, it was for a story about so-called love letters, people shopping for homes, yes, finding so much competition and trying to set themselves apart by writing, you know, heartfelt letters to the sellers about how great they would be as buyers of this home. And, you know, a practice you actually discourage because of the potential fair housing implications. But I wonder, I mean, this was also happening at a time when people were waiving contingencies, you know, waiving the right to even an inspection to buy a house just because of the competition. Has that eased up a bit?
Oh, I would say it hasn't yet, but it should.
Wow.
Because, yes, we've had quite a few months of waiving inspections and covering appraisal gaps. We listed 5 houses last week, and we're seeing that the showings are down and the offers are down. So what used to get 12 to 15 offers might now only get 1 to 3 offers. So we are definitely seeing a slowdown in the amount of buyers that are looking and bidding on homes. So the love letter situation, the appraisal gaps and the waiving inspections, really, I hope, is a thing of the past, because down the road, that could open up a whole can of worms for everyone when they don't do inspections or they're overpaying way more even than the bank thinks it's worth if they're using a lender.
What's your day-to-day like in this market as there's kind of a shift? What kind of conversations are you having with your clients?
So with sellers, it's an expectations conversation. If there's motivated sellers, and same with motivated buyers, if they really have to sell or have to buy, the conversation is just to be smart and to make sure that if they really do, for example, with a buyer, love a house, that they are at least doing inspections for informational purposes. And if they're using a lender, that they're not being kind of too pie in the sky with the appraisal gaps, so that they have some sort of expectation with where they're going to end up when they finally settle on the price of the house, if they're the winner. And making sure that everyone who's kind of been exhausted with this market kind of tones it down, and then finding the motivated are the most important people for realtors to be working with. Really, the numbers don't lie. And we can see as realtors that the market is correcting and the days on market is going up. Price reductions are coming in, and it's opening up for the buyers a little bit more opportunity to get a house and not lose so many times, because that's been very difficult for a lot of buyers.
Amanda Pullman is a broker at Keller Williams Living in the Cleveland area. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Amy.
If fireworks are part of your July 4th weekend, count yourself lucky, and not just because of the aforementioned inflation and supply chain issues. Communities in several drought-plagued states are taking a pass this year because of wildfire risk. This is shaping up to be another extreme fire season, which means more demand for airplanes that drop fire retardant on wildfires and the pilots who fly those planes. Agencies like the Forest Service often use private contractors, but when resources are short, a specialized team of military personnel can help. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck has that story.
I'm in Boise, Idaho, near the National Interagency Fire Center. We're waiting for a few planes to fly by. One smaller lead plane, and a bigger one that'll drop thousands of gallons of water as training for fighting wildfires. The pilots talk over the radio.
For this case, this direct turn coming to a downwind.
Copy that. We're with you. 4,000 right now, pulling in behind you.
Their plan is to drop from west to east. And they're going to drop at 150 feet at about 120 knots, 3,000 gallons of water, just obviously a training run.
That last voice is Varun Purohit, a Wyoming Air National Guard pilot. He works with this program called MAFFS, spelled M-A-F-F-S.
So MAFFS, what it stands for, is Modular Airborne Firefighting System.
MAFFS crews fly C-130 planes owned by the Department of Defense.
We can fly anywhere in the world, do low-level flying, airdrop missions, just hauling things from one, point A to point B.
The Forest Service budgets $2.5 million for this week-long training with about 400 participants. Agency officials say for the last 2 years, all eight of MAFFS air tankers were called in to help fight wildfires. Those planes are based in Colorado Springs, Colorado, Cheyenne, Wyoming, Reno, Nevada, and near Oxnard, California. But the planes will fly wherever they're needed. Lieutenant Colonel Purohit flew in from Cheyenne. He's a MAFFS commander in training, and he likes the challenge of fighting fires.
This is probably the most difficult mission as far as the actual, no kidding, flying, because we're at high altitudes. It's very hot. The aircraft is, you're basically max performing the aircraft.
Challenges also include flying these massive planes low and slow through heavy smoke and mountainous terrain. Last year, an air tanker pilot from a private company died in northern Colorado while trying to help fight the Kruger Rock fire at night, something that isn't generally done because it's so dangerous. A few years ago, two Idaho pilots died along the Utah-Nevada border fighting another large fire. But Purohit says when he's fighting fires, he gets to see the direct effects of his work.
We just dropped on the edge of the fire. That line held. We helped the guys on the ground do their job.
It's not just pilots training in Boise, though. There are also ground crews and flight engineers, like Chief Master Sergeant Cameron Peters. He came up from Reno, where he's part of the Nevada Air National Guard. He says engineers like him monitor all kinds of systems and make sure checklists are completed.
They're really the conscience of the crew. They bring adult supervision to the flight deck.
And for Peters, wildfire fighting does have its challenges.
You may show up somewhere where the terrain is very rugged, where the smoke is very thick, and exciting is probably not the word I'd use. I'd use spicy or sporty.
This special MAFFS team is only called when there aren't enough contractors for the Forest Service to tackle big wildfires. If that happens, Peters says this training will make sure they're ready.
This is where we get to knock off the cobwebs, knock off the dust, and make sure that we're able to go out there and execute based on the level that the U.S. Forest Service needs us to do during fire season.
Back on the landing strip, two planes, a small one followed by a massive C-130 Hercules air tanker, approach where I'm standing. It drops a curtain of water on a grassy area in front of us. The air tanker is emblazoned with a big number 3, and its home base is back in Wyoming. That is, until it's called out. Maybe to help firefighters who could use some backup. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
Coming up,
a luxury adoption experience.
Ooh, fancy. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets here in the U.S. were, of course, closed for the Independence Day holiday, but it was business as usual everywhere else. In Europe, Britain's FTSE rose almost 0.9%. France's CAC 40 picked up 0.4%. Germany's DAX slipped 0.3%. Some context for Mitchell Hartman's story on Americans cutting back their travel plans for the summer. 6.75 million people passed through TSA checkpoints Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. That's way more than on the equivalent days in either of the past 2 years, but still over 500,000 shy of 2019. Those flyers faced a whole bunch of disruptions, as Mitchell called them, delays and cancellations. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. If you know brands like Ben & Jerry's ice cream, Dove soap, and Lipton tea, and a gazillion others, then you know Unilever. The food, beauty, and home care giant is one of Britain's biggest corporations. But a billionaire American investor, Nelson Peltz, has recently taken a stake in the company, along with a seat on the board. While Peltz is known for shaking up underperforming businesses by slashing costs, Unilever claims to have a deeper purpose. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Every day, Unilever does good for communities across America.
Unilever regards itself as a champion of social justice, a campaigner against environmental harm.
We're committed to doing more good.
But that altruistic image projected through brands like Dove soap, Hellmann's mayonnaise, and Domestos disinfectant has palled, for shareholders at least, says Russell Mould, investment director at stockbroking firm AJ Bell. He says Unilever hasn't been doing much good where it really matters.
The shares have underperformed badly relative to the UK market and its global peers.
Nestle and Procter & Gamble shares have risen strongly over the past 5 years. Unilever's are down by more than 10%. And, says Mould, some investors blame the company's do-good culture.
Someone criticised the company for being too obsessed with environmental and social governance issues when they want them to make more mayonnaise and sell more products.
Matthew Lesh of the Free Market Institute of Economic Affairs echoes that sentiment.
Unilever has been too focused on social purpose rather than actually delivering profits to shareholders.
The company's been distracted, he says, preoccupied with promoting marquee liberal causes.
Things like LGBT plus rights, addressing the climate crisis, as well as taking a stand against Brexit.
And Brexit was one of the targets of Unilever's most activist brand, which hails from Vermont.
At Ben & Jerry's, we're always looking for ways to top your favourite flavours.
The ice cream maker has not only tweeted against Brexit, but also against the UK government's immigration policy. And in a protest against Israel, it refused to sell its products in occupied Palestinian territory. A boycott that Unilever ended after a hail of criticism. For a consumer product company, says Lesh, all this is playing with fire.
In many respects, it can undermine a brand, particularly when it takes such stringent positions. It can alienate many of its customers.
Unilever did not respond to our request for comment, but the company does have its supporters. Simon Rawson of Share Action, which promotes socially and environmentally responsible investing.
I don't have a problem at all with brands having purposes. I think they can be really helpful.
Unilever, he says, has undeniably done some good.
For example, I think is one of the leaders globally in committing to pay living wages for people throughout its extensive supply chains.
It's campaigned against plastic pollution and, through its beauty products, tried to shift perceptions of physical perfection, taking the pressure off young people.
The work that they've been doing to challenge stereotypes around body images, I think that's laudable.
And he says it does all make perfect commercial sense for a consumer product company.
Consumers are increasingly moving away from brands which they know are unsustainable or socially irresponsible, either through its exploitative labour practices or through its environmental credentials.
But even supporters say that Unilever's political activism can be polarising. Just like Marmite, the company's most divisive brand, a pungent British savoury spread actually advertised under the slogan, "You either love it or hate it."
It tastes of sunshine.
I hate it! It makes me cry!
As a fearsome activist investor takes a seat on the Unilever board, Britain's commentariat is also divided. For some, it's a rude awakening for a woke corporation. For others, a potential setback for concerned capitalism. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Animal adoptions, as you know, have soared during the pandemic. This very household gained first one stray kitten and then another one to keep that kitten company, allergies be damned. But what if you could just hang out with some cats and then go home? For today's installment of our series, My Economy, we hear from one entrepreneur offering just such an experience.
My name is Angeli Rodriguez. I live in St. John's, Florida, and I run the Witty Whisker Cat Cafe in St. Augustine, Florida. I like to describe a cat cafe as a luxury adoption experience. So we have people pay a small admission fee to go into the cat room. It helps us offset the costs of our rent and, you know, keep the lights on, so to speak. And then we've also got a cafe, an actual cafe, completely separated from the cat room. And it's just a place where you can grab something to eat. And then if you want to go experience a nice, cozy, you know, time with the cats, you can take your drinks in with you. And so you can actually feel what it would be like to be at home, you know, drinking a nice cup of tea with a little cat curled up on your lap. Initially, when I finished my business plan and I went to the bank and applied for a loan, and I got pretty far into the process. But then it kind of at the end, they were just like, no, it's too high risk. And so I was like, ah, bummer. So what we did instead was we tapped into our own personal finances and we were able to get money out of our 401k to get the business rolling. We also were very lucky to have a gift from family members that helped us significantly as well. So we hardly had any customers that first year. And so there were times when we did have to put, you know, influxes of cash into the business ourselves. Most of it was our own personal money. There were days when I didn't even make enough money to cover my labor costs, but we made it. We're dealing with some pretty severe supply chain issues right now. Prices are going up across the board. Costs of cups, syrups, coffee, and it's been a little challenging. I mean, and don't even get me started on milk. I would love to franchise the Witty Whisker. I was thinking about it, and I think I would like for it to be a supplement to all the animal shelters and the rescues that there are out there. I think cat cafes are the way to help really showcase your kitties and help them get adopted quickly. I hope I can actually be helpful and make the world a better place this way.
That was Angeli Rodriguez down in Florida. We can't do this series without you, so please go to marketplace.org. Let us know what's going on in your economy. This final note on the way out, families went back to the movies over the holiday weekend. CNBC reports the new Minions movie, The Rise of Gru, brought in $108 million in North American ticket sales, more than $200 million globally. The disappointing debut of Pixar's Lightyear last month had analysts wondering if parents of young kids were still avoiding theaters amidst the pandemic. Lightyear did just $51 million in domestic sales its opening weekend, less than half the Minions haul. One analyst told CNBC, when the right content is out there, people will show up. And not just families with kids, apparently, but also a lot of young men wearing suits, calling themselves gentle minions. It's a thing. Look it up. Okay, we've got to go. No time for economic context today. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Young, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Amy Scott. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM,